How are you, sir?
Oh, man, I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How was Bitcoin Takeover at South by Southwest last week?
It was awesome. Takeover was the culmination of like an entire week of Bitcoin content. And I was speaking at the Takeover. So like right. The whole week I was kind of dreading, you know, excited, but also dreading when you have a speaking engagement.
Yeah.
And so I was just getting more and more tired every late night at a Bitcoin event. And I'm like, all right, I got to have energy for Friday. But it ended up going really well. I think the talk was good, but also the content from all the other speakers was pretty solid.
Well, fantastic. What was any particular takeaways of last week's sessions or interactions? What's the vibe?
Yeah, what is the vibe? I mean, people are obviously excited. I think one of the general vibes is that there's been a shift now where last year people were worried about being thrown in jail. And now they're worried if it's going to be Bitcoin only or if, you know, altcoins are going to make it into the reserve. So it's been quite a shift in the worries that we have on our plate and the arguments that we're having online.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is an embarrassment of riches in some ways, and yet keep pushing. What was the attendance like? I mean, what did you at Commons? Was it full house, usual suspects or some new faces, hopefully?
Yeah, it was pretty packed. I think they were trying to max out the fire code. So I think we hit about 300 people. It was standing room only in there. A lot of the usual suspects, a lot of new faces as well. I chatted with one guy who was a stay-at-home dad for years. And this was his first time kind of venturing back out into the marketplace. He and his wife are swapping. She's going to be stay-at-home now. And so he was looking to get out and network with people and has an interest in Bitcoin. And so I thought that was awesome. Like somebody who's just kind of interested and trying to network, great place to start.
Terrific. Yeah. I think, you know, it's at least over the last few years, given my focus in Lightning and payments, it's been tempting to want to hope that merchants and small business and, you know, but I think it begins with the individual. It's all about the individual. So that's great to see.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, let's dive in. It's all right.
Okay.
I was thinking to myself this morning I still have Mutiny Wallet installed on my iPhone. I have not yet been able to remove that. But maybe starting there, not to rehash too much of that. I mean, I'll make sure to cover in the show notes some of that backdrop for those who are interested. But I mean, it was and is, as it lives on in open source, a bold experiment in, broadly speaking, user control and privacy. And so I'd love to understand, you know, coming out of that and transitioning or transforming, if you will, into Open Secret, what did you take from, what informed the creation of Open Secret from the foundations of Mutiny Wallet?
Sure. Yeah. So I wasn't there on day one with the company Mutiny, but I was there as a user on day one. I was following along. I was right with you, you know, downloading the app, first running it in the web as a progressive web app. And then once they launched on the App Store, had that as well. And it was my Lightning wallet of choice. I was using it for everything. And really, I think the goal was to take this really complex thing of Lightning and help people run it easily on their mobile device. But then the biggest unlock was being able to synchronize that across all your devices, because Lightning has to be always on in order to accept payments. It has to be, you know, have to be running your own server. And that's what made it so complicated. So Mutiny guys thought, let's just try and simplify it. And then people can have it, you know, in their browser. And when they want to accept payments, how do we do that? Well, they innovated some ways to do like blind tokens and use eCash to accept payments for you when you're offline. There was really cool stuff that was going on. But the difficult part was, it's a difficult user experience. And one of the biggest drawbacks was having users manage their own private key. And so when I joined Mutiny, the goal was, let's take this to millions of users, hopefully billions of users, right, at some point in the distant future. But it was like this non-starter where if you are going to just a regular average user who just downloads apps and uses them, and the first interaction is write down these 12 words, if you lose them, you're going to lose all your money. Like that's they just get scared of that and go away. So we were trying to figure out how to solve that problem. And we started looking at secure enclaves. The Mutiny guys were at the Sovereign Engineering Cohort number one in Madeira. and while we were there chatting with some people and learning about secure enclaves in the cloud, and thought this is a really interesting technology. I wonder if we can utilize this. And so as we were looking at Mutiny and scaling it, then there were a lot of variables at play there, but it turned out that as a company we needed to kind of pivot away from scaling Mutiny and try to do something else. But one of the something else's we wanted to do was to build an eCash wallet that could scale to millions of users. And again, we kept running into this problem of the UX, the user experience. Like, we have to win on user experience. And we looked at secure enclaves and said, this is how we do it. We can use secure enclaves to manage the private key for the user. They don't have to worry about it when they first get in. But at some point, you can prompt them and say, hey, it would be great if you downloaded your private key, saved it as a backup, you know, but you can do that when you actually have developed a relationship with them rather than right off the bat. And as we looked around, there was nothing out there for using secure enclaves for mobile apps. They are used primarily inside large organizations for securing like internal process controls. And so we thought, okay, if we are going to use secure enclaves, we need to build a platform to do that for ourselves. And it was at that point we realized, well, instead of having just one eCash wallet or one Mutiny wallet that uses secure enclaves, why don't we open this up and hopefully have hundreds of apps that have the same privacy, the same security that Mutiny wallet or, you know, or such could have. So that was a long ramble there a bit, but that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
Absolutely. And I think maybe for those who aren't familiar, I mean, I think of, right or wrong, I think of trusted execution environments. I think of early Intel chip architecture, ME engine, I forget some of these, but give us, will you mark a primer on secure enclaves? What is it in a nutshell? What is it as a technology, and what does it seek to solve, or what does it in fact solve?
Yeah. So a lot of phrases you might hear, you mentioned trusted execution environments, TEEs, secure enclaves, secure elements. You might hear confidential computing. A lot of these are all referring to roughly the same thing. And that is, if you look at your phone, right, you have your phone in your pocket, it has a secure enclave in it. They've been in there for over a decade. And it is a secure chip where you can stick code inside of this chip and the code is running. But then the data that it talks to, you cannot see. So this data is encrypted before it enters into the chip. And once it goes into the chip, only the chip can decrypt it and then run the code against that. And then when it spits it out the other end, it is re-encrypted again. And so no human has the ability to intercept that data in a plain text state. So effectively, that's all it is. On your device, it is securing your thumbprint, your face ID, your wallet, driver's license, that kind of stuff. But then they've moved them to the cloud now. So Intel was one of the first with Intel SGX. If you do any research, you'll find that there were some vulnerabilities with that. That was like the older generation. Now they've moved on to the Intel TDX. Amazon has one they call AWS Nitro. NVIDIA has their own that they're doing on top of GPUs. And then Amazon recently announced their own GPU thing, just, you know, like very recently. And I'm curious to see what they're going to do as far as encrypted GPUs for theirs as well. So there's a lot going on here. But effectively, you can just think of it as the analogy I like to use is if you're in the kitchen and you are baking your favorite cookies, right? Well, you're going to get a recipe and I'm going to give you a recipe to follow. And that recipe is like the code that you would put inside the secure enclave. So you take my recipe, but I'm not there in the kitchen with you watching you actually bake. And so I don't see which kinds of ingredients you use. I don't see which kind of flour you use, what kind of chocolate chips or, which kind of milk you use. So that data that you put in there is private to you. But the recipe that is being used is open. It's out on the internet. Everybody can see which recipe is being followed. It's an analogy that seems to kind of resonate with people that that really the secure element, the secure enclave is a verifiable code that's out in the open for everybody to audit, but the data that passes through cannot be seen by anyone.
And I would imagine you have run through a few dozen of these metaphors to lock into one because it is complex. It is challenging
to get that across,
but great job. I like it. and as you say, Mark, we've been carrying these pieces of hardware on our phones at least for a decade. What have been some of the most notable breakthroughs you know, and I'll throw in that, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe wallets, the digital wallets that we carry, I'm an iPhone carrier and person, so I am not as deeply familiar with Android, but I believe it's safe to say on both sides, differential privacy that I know Apple has put at the center, be it in the way it applies AI to photos and the like. Can you paint a picture there of you know, what has it brought us, let's say, over the last 5 to 10 years?
Sure. I think that they're getting the benefit of, and that is these ephemeral credit card numbers. So it used to be, I don't know how often you've had to change a credit card number because you had some kind of charge that happened, but it's happened to me multiple times. And so I'd call up the credit card company and say, this charge was not mine, and they would have to give me an all new number. Well, now, with the wallet that is on there secured by the Enclave, Apple's able to generate a new credit card number for you per transaction, per vendor. And so I think that's a big benefit. So now if one is compromised, they don't have to change your entire credit card number over. Another very notable case that was in the news, when was this, like 2015, 2017, was the shooter incident in San Bernardino, California, where there was a person who, you know, unfortunately was engaged in a shooting event. And the FBI wanted Apple to unlock the phone for them. They couldn't get in. They couldn't get in through the PIN. The secure enclave was securing the identity on the phone. And Apple stood their ground and said, we're not going to compromise the device. Basically, the FBI wanted them to ship a modified firmware to the phone that would unlock the secure enclave. And Apple stood the ground and said, we're not going to unlock the enclave because that creates a backdoor that's vulnerable for anyone to get into. And so this was a test of the enclave, showing that even the FBI was having a hard time getting in and finding this information. I hesitate to use that as an example because it's such a tragic event, but it was one to show that the enclaves are really secure in that regard.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as we could spend a lot of time talking about it, is whether we look to the UK with them now trying to yet again force a backdoor on Apple devices and Apple deactivating their iCloud end-to-end security in response. It is those extreme edge cases that test either the viability of the technology, or in this case, perhaps the commitment of a technology company to use it for the good of their customers and not create what we know that does not work, which is a backdoor for one, but not for all. So from what we've seen secure enclaves enable, what remains? Or rather, what are some of the more egregious challenges, problems, risks to trust and privacy that we endure that you foresee secure enclaves addressing? And certainly we'll talk about Maple AI.
Sure. Man, there's so many. So really, it's kind of this upgrade for security on the internet that I think that we are about to embark upon with HTTP. Everybody types in the URL, they go HTTP, you know, /www, whatever. And that was all just out in the plain and it was insecure. So then when all of our banks started coming online, and we started having usernames and passwords, we realized we needed this to be secure. So we upgraded the entire internet to HTTPS. It took over a decade to get everybody on board, but we eventually made it. Now pretty much everything goes secure. However, that only secures data in transit, right? So your user, your password, if you're on a public Wi-Fi trying to log into your bank, it is relatively safe to do that. However, once your data gets in the back end of that bank, or let's just talk about some random app you have on your phone. You're going on a run around your neighborhood and it's tracking your location constantly. You don't really know who that developer is. You don't know who they hired at their company. You don't know who they recently fired at their company who might have taken data from their servers. And so you're trusting them with your daily location where you go on a run that could leave you vulnerable. And that data is not encrypted to you. It is open to them. They can share that with advertisers. They can share that with the government. Data hackers can get in and steal that. So it is this privacy trade-off that we don't quite think through a lot. We don't realize that we're doing that. But if you look at every app on your phone, you're effectively leaking your data to unknown people all the time. And so I think we are going to witness a third upgrade now to the internet, and that is secure enclaves. I'm calling it HTTPSE for secure enclaves, but effectively, I think every app needs to start using enclaves to not only protect user privacy, right, where you can encrypt every single user individually, but it also protects the developer and their liability. In 2024, we did some research on data hacks that happened, data breaches, and the average cost to a U.S. company when there was a data breach was about $9 million. In 2023, it was lower. It was like in the fours or fives. But that's a significant liability that you're hanging on to as an app provider if you are custodying, that's a hard word, if you're taking custody of user personal identifiable information. And so we think that secure enclaves are going to be a way to protect businesses and users.
And I think I was out for a walk earlier today listening to a conversation. I believe it was Kali, and don't know the other. It was just one of these, you know, you grab Fountain Podcast app and do a search and hit play. And it was about certainly a conversation I'm hearing happen more often, which is from don't be evil to can't be evil, and from personal data as an asset, as the new oil, goes the cliche, to an absolute liability. So, you know, collect it all, to collect less, to collect none. Talk to me a bit about that. I mean, where could it go? Where are you seeing some of the more progressive early adopter, you know, customers, companies start to poke around in terms of their ability to collect less or collect none?
I like that phrase change from don't be evil to can't be evil. Because if I can be evil in any way, like if that's a possibility, then there's the possibility of me getting a knock on my door at 3 o'clock in the morning from the government to unlock someone's account. And I just don't want to have that liability on me. I've got a family. I've got a life to live. So I would rather create an awesome user experience for our users without unknowing what they're doing effectively.
Is it overly hopeful to think that there is a trend in that direction from collect it all to at least collect as little as possible? And I in America, perhaps other places, it's different. But I think I carve healthcare aside, you know, the HIPAA Act and some of the related legislation at least creates the facade. I don't know that they're a sterling example of protecting, you know, PII or personal health information. So there or elsewhere, are you seeing a trend, or are we very, very early? And certainly Open Secret is looking to push those boundaries.
So I think we're early in many regards. Before we decided to pivot into Open Secret, we had meetings with a handful of developers, call it 10 different developers, from just the regular mobile app space. I come from mobile apps. I worked at a few different startups as an early employee. And so I've been doing mobile development since really before the App Store even launched. And so we had a lot of conversations with people, and it was about 50-50. Half of them were on board with the idea that they wanted to provide users their privacy and also protect themselves from liability. The other half told us, yeah, I'm not super interested in that. Part of it is that they actually like the ability to monetize their user data. And so that's been a big part of the business model for so long. Advertising, user data monetization, you talk about data being the new oil. So I think it's going to take time to migrate away from that. And there could be a hybrid approach where you actually, and this was a couple of the developers who talked to said they would like to take this approach where you lock down the most sensitive information, but then you still can share non-PII within the system and provide trends and analysis and maybe do the advertising model on top of that. But you do create this separation, which is extremely important. And so that's really where we are trying to start, is that if you're an app developer starting out building an app today, most of them don't even think about privacy. They don't look long-term to say, what's going to happen if I have all this user data? They're just concerned with, can I build this user experience and will I get downloads, right?
SQL and a Docker container and just start grabbing everything.
Yeah, well, and you look at tools like Replit or Bolt.fun where people are just typing in prompts now and they're just vibe coding into an app. And then they put it out there and ask people to start using it. That's what they're concerned with right now. And they don't think about the fact that if this thing goes viral and takes off, they might suddenly have a database full of this information that they really shouldn't be holding on to. And so we would like to create that same experience, but have privacy turned on by default, have encryption turned on by default. So when they YOLO into something and vibe code and all the buzzwords you want to say, right? Like when they get into it, they are protected from day one and their users are protected from day one. There's no reason why it shouldn't be that way. The only reason is that it hasn't been built yet. And so that's why we're building it.
It's the foot guns are there waiting, I think, when you take that approach. Well, I think that's a great segue, Mark, into your sister company or product, at least Maple AI. You'll correct me on that. It is no surprise, certainly to me, that LLMs and AI are where you began because of the sheer volume of data, the uptake, the utilization. I spend probably an hour a day in various AI products. So how does Maple AI make these interactions more trustworthy, if that is the right word, than what's out there today, be it a Grok, an OpenAI, or others? What's fundamentally different? And second, I'd love to know your take on today, at least, what are we sacrificing to get those benefits that, in this case, Maple AI and OpenSecret deliver?
Mm-hmm.
What's the trade-off?
Well, Maple was really born out of those developer conversations we had when we were pitching OpenSecret to developers. Pretty much 100% of them, close to 100%, said, hey, if you had some kind of AI app where I could chat privately with AI, I'd be all over that. And so that's why we decided to build that. It was a way to figure out if OpenSecret is even possible, because we didn't want to build a platform for developers before understanding if the UX was even possible to accomplish. We wanted that rock solid UX of download an app, log in with email, log in with, you know, whatever OAuth, Google, Twitter, what have you, and now you're in with a private key and end-to-end encrypted. And so Maple was our way to prove that. And I'm really happy that we did, because it's a phenomenal app. It's really easy to use, and it helps with those trade-offs that you're alluding to here and that you're asking about. And that is, when you go use ChatGPT or Grok, they're amazing tools. They're phenomenal. They do a lot of great things. They have a lot of great functionality. A lot of functionality we don't have in Maple yet. But the trade-off you're making is you are sacrificing your privacy to the companies. So as you type in your information, everything you type is stored permanently on their servers and then used to train their models in the future. Now, for some people, I mean, so many people, I'm sure you've run across this, so many people you talk to, they don't see that as a problem, right? I don't have anything to hide. Why should I care if I'm giving up my privacy? But our privacy is really important for maintaining open societies, for maintaining open markets, for maintaining these freedoms that we enjoy. Because when we give up our privacy, we allow authority, we allow people to come in to start inserting themselves in the process, and they can create roadblocks, they can create censorship, they can shut us down. So we need to maintain that barrier.
Now, from the right to selectively disclose. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was Snowden or far, you know, long before him, but that's the phrase that sticks with me, is even if you presume you have nothing to hide, it is maintaining, defending the right for selective disclosure.
Yeah, it's a great quote. So that's really where we're at with AI and with Maple. And from a practical standpoint, the more that you tell to these other services, the more that it can be used in the future, which can be convenient. But then you have to realize you don't know who is at that company again, right? OpenAI hires dozens of people and employs so many individuals, and you don't know who is accessing your data. And it might be very personal information, conversations that you might have just between you and a family member, right? You and your significant other, you are now sharing with random people. And so Maple AI gives you that ability. And high level, what Maple AI does is it creates a private key for you in the secure enclave. It encrypts your chat that you make on your device, and then it sends it to our servers. And then not only do we have that encryption happening in the enclave, but we also have a second one, which is encryption on the GPU. So we have the open source large language model booted up in the GPU. And so your request is passed along, encrypted to the GPU as well. So nobody is able to see what is being chatted about. The GPU comes up with a response. with the LLM, sends it back encrypted back to your device. So the whole pipeline is encrypted, which means that we have no censorship in there. We don't sanitize anything. We just give you a raw open source model and let you talk to it. Now, it is based on Meta's Llama 3.3 at the moment. We want to bring other ones online soon. We're working through that. We actually currently have an LLM provider that we use, but because they use GPUs that are encrypted, we can verify the whole process and know that they are end-to-end encrypted as well. So we're looking at how we spin up our own encrypted models. But yeah, the only kind of censorship you might get is the model itself, the data that it was trained on, right? The biases, the weights that it has in it that might tilt one way or another politically. But we do our best to, we want to find models that are the least, you know, politically motivated as possible. And then we don't do anything to insert ourselves in the middle of that process.
And what, I mean, I when I initially signed up for Maple AI, I used GitHub authentication, and it was absolutely seamless. There was absolutely nothing about it that felt different, other than understanding a bit more about what was going on behind the scenes. Talk more about those. Well, perhaps the trade-off is in the model and what's required. I mean, I'll shamelessly sort of say that Grok is my preferred at this point. It's just mind-blowing for various reasons. So, you know, where is the line, I guess, in terms of what's possible with open secret and secure enclaves? And where is your place in that ecosystem as you see it today?
So I'm definitely not going to be building my own data center and doing all the cool stuff that Elon's doing. I think it's top-notch what they're trying to accomplish. So for us, I don't look at Maple AI as like the only AI tool that people should have. There are so many tools out there, and so it should be one tool in your toolbox. You know, if you are trying to fix something in your house, you're going to go out in your garage, you're going to open up your drawer, you're open up your box, and there are 20 or 30 different tools in there, and you need a different tool for a different situation. And so I use Grok all the time. I use ChatGPT. I use Venice AI. I use a lot of other AI services for different purposes. But I'm so glad that I have Maple there as well, because when there are chats, things that I want that are just should be more private, then I have that tool to use. And so Maple, it actually has a very long roadmap. We have a long strategy for Maple. It started, you know, it was a glint in our eye as a proof of concept, but then very quickly we realized there's so much more here. So we are going to continue adding features into Maple. It is going to become more feature rich. It will be someplace that can sit side by side with ChatGPT and some of these other services. But then Maple is also a service for other app developers. And so it plays into this whole ecosystem of Open Secret. Let's go back to that that running app that you might be using. So you're tracking your runs around your neighborhood. Well, if that developer is built on Open Secret, they're using it to secure your location data. So now your location data is private. But what if they want to use AI to help you make decisions about, like, how can you have a better running schedule? Maybe you want to run a marathon. It's like, okay, based on how your running history has gone, let me use AI to build you out a plan to get there. The current option right now is for them to grab an API key from someone like ChatGPT. And now they have to break that privacy wall. They have to take your private, really sensitive information and go give it to OpenAI. And that is not a great compromise to make. And so Maple is actually going to be part of the Open Secret ecosystem. So they can now have a private AI to chat with, to bring within their app and stay within that privacy ecosystem. So we see Maple as both a really solid consumer app and business app. We have a lot of business users on Maple already. So that we will continue to iterate there. And then as that gets stronger, it is going to be stronger for the developers who are using private AI, and vice versa. When developers ask us for things that they want to do in the private AI space, that will go into Maple AI as an end user product, and both will get better at the same time.
Terrific. And that makes a ton of sense. In fact, you touched on one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is, it seems to me, I'm no expert here, that in enterprise use, certainly OpenAI and others, and you know, not to speak ill of any of them, but they've got their team licenses. Every time I sign into one of these products, they want to push me to upgrade to team, to a team product or team license. That to me seems particularly problemsome in terms of rags or otherwise training these models on intellectual property that is, you know, belongs to the company, sensitive documents, whatever that case may be. Talk to me a bit about what that looks like. And here too, I mean, you know, are you bullish on enterprise uptake or, you know, do they suffer some of the same challenges collectively that individuals do, which is, it's not a problem. We'll just give it to OpenAI.
If you go look around on Reddit and some of the forums, you'll find countless people saying that they have no problem sharing their company information with OpenAI, which is unfortunate, right? That's just the nature of it. So, some people don't realize, like, it's not a, they just think it's not a big deal.
Now, we question whether those are officers of the company hanging out on Reddit saying those things.
Yeah.
But probably not. Probably someone who, you know, doesn't get perp walked out the front door if they break a reg.
Yeah, that's right. And I can understand where they're coming from, right? Maybe you're running some small business in a town, and if you are thinking that sharing information with ChatGPT, that the threat is ChatGPT is going to come take over your business, like that's the wrong threat vector to be thinking about. Really what it is that you are training ChatGPT's models to benefit your competitor that's in the same town as you, because they're going to go to ChatGPT and start asking questions about, hey, how do I spin up this thing? How do I do a marketing campaign in this market? And if you were using it 6 months prior or a year prior, your data is now part of that brain that is going to make recommendations to your competitors. So you're making the system smarter to not only benefit you, but benefit those around you. And as a business person, you need to make that call, right? Do you want to improve it for your competitors or not? Whereas with something like Maple, you can bring your chats in there. We're adding document upload soon, so you'll be able to upload your documents and do kind of your own RAG type stuff. And you'll be able to go over strategy, marketing plans, customer service ideas, write documentation. There'll be all sorts of things that you can do within Maple that won't be shared with anybody. They will stay local to you and private to you. And that's really a big competitor advantage for business users, is that they can have this AI that they bring into their strategy room, right? You bring the smartest people in your room, you close the door and you have a conversation. Well, now you can bring Maple in there too and trust that, and you can verify, you don't have to trust us. You can verify cryptographically that your information is not being spilled out anywhere.
And is there, I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it. Are there clear trade-offs in the sense that what you just described, which is fantastic, sounds like I can have my cake and eat it too. I can benefit from models trained on this massive corpus of data and information across the internet. You know, Grok presumably excels because it has real-time access to X. So I can take advantage of that baseline, augment through my own documents, my own data. Are there obvious, or do you foresee places where it breaks and where, you know, the YOLO approach of an OpenAI or whoever outpaces those who've elected to apply your similar technology? So are there trade-offs that are apparent?
The AI race right now is very exhausting. If you're online at all, every week there are new advances happening. So I definitely feel the anxiety and the struggle of, like, if we're going to have a product like Maple AI, we have to be able to keep up in some regard with all the advances that Grok and OpenAI are making, DeepSeek, Mistral. Everybody's throwing out new stuff constantly and doing great work. I think what we need to do is we need to provide a base level of features for our users and do it in a way that is private. And then we kind of have the benefit of also building OpenSecret that has Maple built into it. And we would be extremely fine and happy if a developer came along and built a Maple competitor on top of OpenSecret. I would have no problem with that, because the technology is all there. The tools are all there for them to do that. And if they want to go after a market, like if they want to do image generation, for example, we don't do image gen inside of Maple. There are reasons why we haven't done that yet. We might do it in the future. But if somebody wants to come build that on top of OpenSecret, by all means, have at it. Make it a phenomenal business for yourself. Scale it to millions of users. That'd be great. And so really, we're looking at, as we want to use Maple ourselves. I use it daily. I use it for my own. Like I have a personal assistant prompt that I use to prioritize my day. I use it for doing strategy, for doing marketing, all sorts of things. And so I want to continue to use it. And we will continue to keep Maple usable for business use cases as long as there isn't another competitor that is as private. If somebody builds something as private as Maple and is more full-featured, then at that point, we start to look at the cost benefit of maintaining Maple or, you know, winding it down. But I don't think the private AI part of OpenSecret will ever go away. That's going to be a mainstay of it. And so there will always be some really strong private AI functionality in OpenSecret. And there will always be end user apps on OpenSecret that provide private AI. Don't know if that answers your question, but that's absolutely the thought.
And it seems to me that I have these conversations often, particularly with friends, colleagues who are developers who push back, you know, and they've heard the examples of just half-baked code that Cursor or something, you know, not to pick on someone, but has spit out, and they've got to now spend 10x the time trying to debug it or get it back up and running. But I think it's inevitable. And so in my mind, LLMs, AI broadly, agents are now a foundational element of any sort of system. And so I absolutely hear you there. What comes next? You know, if you're willing to give us a glimpse of what's next in the roadmap, or, you know, if you had your way, who would come knocking on OpenSecret's door and what would they be looking to build?
So for me, the lowest hanging fruit app ideas out there are note-taking apps, journal apps, people who want to write down their thoughts, right? Their daily thoughts or their internal struggles. These are things that are very personal and private. I think those are going to be the first apps that could be written.
And the Obsidian plugin.
Yeah, Obsidian. One of the apps we talked to was Day One. Day mm-hmm. One, right?
You're used to be a heavy user. And when they got dicey on their data policy, I stopped.
Yeah, right. And they did build private end-to-end encryption into it, right? It took them a long time. I was good friends with those guys. I was actually at Apple's developer conference when they won their first Apple Design Award. I got to hold it, take a picture with it. It was fun, right? So nice. They're great guys. But we chatted with their main developer. He's not with them anymore. And he said if OpenSecret was around when they were building it, it would have taken them, you know, like a matter of weeks, maybe a couple months total to implement it. Whereas it took them a year and a half because they had to build it for iOS, they had to build it for Android and for web. And they were figuring it out as they went. Whereas OpenSecret is just build it once, run it everywhere, and you get really strong encryption. So I think those are the first apps. And then obviously AI is a big part of it. So there's going to be a proliferation of AI apps. And then you mentioned AI agents. That's really where we're headed. There's, you know, AI for those listening, if you've heard AI agents, but you're still confused, what the heck are they? They're effectively AI bots. They are specialized AI that know how to do a task. So if you are hungry for dinner that night, right, you would go into your main AI, call it ChatGPT or Maple. You go and say, I'm hungry. Get me some food. ChatGPT doesn't know how to like fulfill your wishes there. All it can do is say, here, let me give you the steps on how to figure out what you want to eat. And then here are the steps on how to order food on DoorDash. And that's where it stops. But with agents, ChatGPT or Maple or some other AI will be able to say, okay, here's what you want to eat. And now let me spin up an agent that knows how to go find restaurants in your area. And then it's going to spin up another agent that knows how to order food on DoorDash. And so it will go spin those up. But those agents are not free, right? They cost compute credits, power, electricity, all that stuff. And so we are going to need to have a way to pay all of them. And that's where eCash comes in. You know, you have Lightning, you have Bitcoin, you have stable coins, you have credit cards that are trying to do this. I don't think credit cards are going to be able to shoehorn themselves into this new paradigm of AI paying each other, because we're talking about
3.25 points per transaction plus 30 cents. I doubt.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about like fractions of a penny per transaction, maybe a few cents. Really, it's a few sats is the term that we should be throwing around. And so what we need is some kind of wallet that's attached to your AI that can then pay other AI agents. And you authorize it. You say, okay, here's your budget. You got $50 in here. And now just use it up as you need to, and then I'll replenish you in the future. And I'm hopeful and bullish that eCash is going to be that solution. I think it was built for this, and it satisfies a real need. And so,
let me pause you there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think on the topic of trust, and I'm dating myself, but I think back to the 90s, the beginning of my career at Microsoft, and we were professing intelligent agents. You know, you stick around long enough, these things always come full circle. But now as then, I think it comes down to what will it take for me to trust to let this thing loose? You know, even I've got a computer science degree, been in tech for my entire career. I pretty deeply understand the technology. I still don't know that I know what it will take for me. What do I need to qualify and quantify giving this thing a wallet, a budget, which, you know, on Nostr Wallet Connect, I can set budgets. All these things are great. I understand them. But I mean, that's sort of the crux of it, I suppose, is how far away are we, do you think, from this being in the wild? And what is your take on how Secure Enclaves, Open Secrets specifically addresses that gap, that trust gap of, okay, yes, I'm going to give it a leash and let it run?
Yeah. There, in my mind, as I'm listening to you, I think you are describing two different definitions of trust there. So the first one is, do you trust it to be effective, right? Do you trust to let these AIs go and do the thing that you want? And so if you want to eat food for dinner that night, do you trust that it's actually going to bring you food that you like, or is it going to bring you some styrofoam that you don't want to eat at all? So that is something that we can just play out through the user experience and trial and error and make sure that we trust that's going to happen. Then there's the deeper version of trust of, do I actually think that it's going to be benevolent and it's going to act on my behalf, that it's not going to have bugs that will suddenly spend my entire wallet in one swoop.
And hallucinates. I think hallucination, yeah, in the age of LLMs is, perhaps for me at least, re-injected that concern. You know, you see how far off the track these things can go.
Yeah, definitely. And I think agents, hallucination is definitely a big part of chat. And I think agents have an opportunity to be more transactional, where they can write unit tests and they can prove things and say, if the input is this, make sure the output is this, and don't stray from that. And so I think we might be able to have more provable trust in that kind of design. But, you mentioned working at Microsoft. I used to work at Apple. When you're in these big corporations, you have these thresholds of payments that can be approved, right? So all these different managers you have above you, they each have their own budget level, right? Discretionary spending. They can approve up to $250. The next person can approve up to $250,000 or something. I think that we probably end up in some kind of space like that. And you're seeing that with Nostr Wallet Connect, being able to set a budget for different apps. So maybe you say, right, like, I'm okay with you making decisions up to this point on your own. If it needs to go above that, come back for me for approval, whether that's a push notification that shows up on your phone. I mean, how dope would that be if you're like sitting in a movie or sitting somewhere at a ball game and your phone says, oh, hey, your AI agent wants to do this really important thing for you. Do you approve it? And you're like, oh yeah, for sure. Go for it.
Absolutely.
Maybe it's negotiating your car insurance for you. And it's like, hey, I just found that I can save you $500 a year by switching to this new one. Do you authorize me to do it?
Yes, right. Yes, and I do.
Yes, I would say yes to that. Maybe it gives me a little quick report right there on the screen and I can say yes to that. So I think we need to figure out how do we set up these guardrails so that we do feel comfortable at that level of trust. And then with Open Secret, what we're doing is we are putting open source code out there. This is the code that runs inside the enclaves. And then we have reproducible builds. So any user that wants to can go out, download the code, run the build, and they get a checksum. They get this number that says, this is the fingerprint of the build. And then when you go log into Maple, you actually see the fingerprint that the server is doing. It's called attestation. And you as a user can compare those two fingerprints together and verify that they are correct. Now, the software does that for you. It gives you a green verified badge, a little check mark. But users are able to do that. And to me, that's kind of the final piece to this trust that you're asking about, is we need to see the code. We need to know what's running on these servers, running in the secure enclaves. And with companies like Apple, with their private cloud compute and their Apple Intelligence, they're using secure enclaves. However, Apple doesn't want to open source all of that. And so they're going to third-party auditors, and we have to trust the auditors are looking at the code and verifying it. It's the same thing with Signal. Signal has third-party auditors that come look at their code. And so if you're going to use Signal to chat, you are doing some trust, right? Because you download the app from the App Store. You can't verify, even though Signal publishes their code open source, you can't verify that the build you're downloading is the exact same code that's out on the open source. You can hope, but now you're trusting the third-party auditors that they are saying, yeah, we checked out this build. It is the same code. So there is there's a level of trust there. And with OpenSecret, we're trying to get as close to the user as possible with that trust. We want to bring the code and the user as close together. So that's really what we're going after. And I see there are going to be, obviously, companies do it different ways. And you have to decide as a user for yourself, what is your risk model that you have? How much can you trust someone? And how much do you need to have more eyes on the code yourself?
And I think that brings to mind, I mean, I wonder, Mark, if you and the team didn't have a lot of interesting conversations about business model and monetization versus don't trust, verify. Was that non-trivial, or was it clear from the beginning that you were going to push it as close to the user and have as much visibility and transparency as you've laid out? Because that does seem to me to be at least the reason, if not excuse, that a lot of established companies hold up.
Mm-hmm. This definitely was a big part of the conversation. We very strongly feel like we need to have our code open source. However, we're trying to build a business, especially a SaaS business, and it's a threat, right, to where your software can be copied and someone can spin up a competitor to you. So we looked at the licenses out there. This was controversial within our company in our discussions of which license do we go with. We eventually went with AGPL for the secure enclave code. Maple itself, the client, that is MIT. People are welcome to fork that and do their own commercial products if they want to, and they don't have to contribute back. But we did AGPL for a few reasons. One of them was we are trying to build a business. And so if people are going to copy our code and are going to improve it, we would love for those improvements to come back to us and for there not to be just like a straight competitor right off the bat when we're so small. Another reason is we feel very strongly that secure enclaves, to be effective, need to have their code open source and reproducible. And so if someone's going to take the OpenSecret enclave code, we want them to publish it open source as well for the protection of the users. If our code is going to be securing people's stuff, even if it's on another person's device, another person's server, we want it to be out in the open so that users can be protected. So that's really the approach that we took. It was not an easy decision to make because we wanted to provide the strongest privacy possible, but that's eventually where we landed.
And I think that takes us to the last question I'd love to discuss or raise with you, Mark, which is speaking to business leaders, be they heads of product, heads of engineering, CXOs, in a future where AI, certainly, LLMs, I think we can foresee that become ubiquitous. Other compute intensive and increasingly data hungry applications become ubiquitous. What changes do those incumbent players need to start deliberating and deciding on in order to keep pace and presumably to make the decisions that I think you and I would agree are best for the user and provide the trust that they'll demand?
Trust and privacy have been a nice to have for too long. For decades, they've been a nice to have because in order to build effective cloud environments and to monetize a SaaS product, you almost needed to throw privacy out the window to really make it effective. The technology has finally caught up with things like secure enclaves and with devices having so much power on them. You can run LLM on a mobile phone now pretty effectively. It won't get you everything. The models that we run in the cloud are still way more powerful, but you can get enough sometimes of what you need on there. So the computing has caught up to this, and now we are going to see users caring more about privacy. You look at the political landscape and just what has happened in the last few months, more people are talking about privacy and trust and what does that mean for themselves. I'm not talking just in America. I'm talking, you know, all over the world. Europe is a big example of that. Absolutely. Where privacy is really hanging
under threat, under right? attack, under threat continuously.
Yeah, definitely. So I think if you are at a company, if you have an app that's being used by a lot of people, you need to be watching for a competitor come out that has the trust and the privacy angle that you don't have. And how can you adapt to that? With Open Secret, we don't require people to throw away all their code. We can plug into an existing tech stack. So that was really important to us, that we don't require people to start from scratch. So you could come to talk to us and we can help you start to, you know, secure just pieces of your data. But you don't have to, right? You can download our code and do your own secure enclaves. But I think that every company out there that has a successful app should start looking at secure enclaves and figuring out what user data needs to be public within our database and shared within our database and what does not. Because if it does not need to be shared for like mission critical things to function, you should be locking that down. You should be privatizing it, securing it. It's not only good for your users, it's good for your liability as a business, and it's good for a competitive advantage for those other apps that are going to come along that will be trying to be more secure and be more private.
I wonder, Mark, if you have a perspective on what this does in terms of regulatory advantage or to just minimize the attack surface, if you will, that as companies, and we see this with Apple, we see this with Google, we see this with all the large players, they're running this gauntlet of overlapping and competing regulatory regimes. So do you have a sense of what adopting secure enclaves, adopting Open Secret would do to one's exposure, let's say, to a lot of these messy, sometimes overlapping and competing privacy and regulatory regimes?
That is a heavy question right there. First off, my portion of this podcast is going over Obscura VPN, so I'm going to dox myself a little bit there. It's a great product. I love it.
Fantastic. But and second, you're not a lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a lawyer, so there's the other thing. I think that secure enclaves, they help you when it comes to regulation because you can effectively be hands-off. You know, in the Bitcoin world and the digital currency world, we talk a lot about self-custody. Right, you have your own keys, you secure your own coins. And so a business, if the users have their own keys, they don't have custody of their coins, of their money. And so there are all sorts of regulations and liabilities that don't apply to them. With Open Secret, we are bringing self-custody to your data. And so it's all the same things apply, where the user is in control of their data. You as a provider don't actually have access. You don't have any control over what data that they generate and what they interact with and what they do with that data. So all sorts of liability no longer applies to you in that regard, and regulations don't apply to you. Now, on the flip side, I do wonder if companies that are earliest to embrace your secure enclaves might be some kind of a target for coercion, you know, to come like Apple experienced with the enclaves on the phone. Maybe I do get a knock on my door that says, there is this one specific user. We need you to push an update to this product, knowing that it will actually break the product. So if somebody goes on with Maple, if we push out a nefarious build that doesn't match with the open source version of Maple, your client will not connect. It'll immediately sever the connection and you won't do anything. So you won't be compromised. However, you know, we could push a backdoor for our government to get at one specific user if that user came and logged in. Now, but again, like it requires that user to go on the code. It's a very detailed question, answer, right? I don't want to dig in all the technicalities, but we have set it up to make it that situation nearly impossible to happen. And so, but I do wonder, you know, there is this threat that somebody could come put pressure on us. And so we build all of this cryptography, we build all this encryption in there so that scenario cannot play out. It's basically, I don't want to say impossible, but it's as close to impossible as we can try and make it, so that we can protect ourselves from our users and our users can be protected from us.
It's an excellent point. You know, I came at this from the standpoint, obviously, of what would it do perhaps to demonstrably prove that, hey, I can't help you. But then little if anything stops these government agencies from believing that you can build a backdoor for just them, right? So it's a great point. Well, Mark, I've been looking forward to this conversation and have just been delighted. Really appreciate it. For those, and I'll certainly get this into the show notes, who want to follow you, your work, Open Secret, Maple AI, where should they look? Where should they follow you?
Great. Likewise, I really enjoyed this conversation. Was looking forward to it. I'm on Twitter and Noster. My username on X is marks_FTW for the win. And then on Noster, I'm just marks@primal.net. You can follow me there. And then we have Maple on all the places as well. On X, it's try Maple AI. On Noster, it's just MapleAI@primal.net. And then Open Secret is there as well. Open Secret Cloud is where you'll find our handle. And then our website is available as well, opensecret.cloud. And then I recommend any developer that wants to try out Secure Enclaves or wants to try out Open Secret, first go to Maple. Go to trymaple.ai and see what it's like for an end user. And that is the light bulb moment. Because when you think about building encryption or doing any of these private key things, it's very daunting and you think it's going to be convoluted and difficult to use. So just go to trymaple.ai, log in, and you won't notice that you're using end-to-end encryption. It's that easy. And so that's where I would really point people, is just go create a free account, give it a try, and then you'll taste what it's like to have an app that is built on Open Secret.
Terrific. Yep. I use it. Great product, smooth as can be. And I'm really excited to see iterations of it and what others build. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate the time. Talk to you soon.
Okay. We'll talk to you. Take care. Bye.